Good afternoon, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this side event. The Swiss Foreign Ministry is very pleased to sponsor this side event together with BASIC, the British American Security Information Council, on the topic Strengthening Non-Proliferation, Game-Changing Ideas. As you all know, the Secretary-General made a quote that people often refer to, there are no right hands for wrong weapons. And this, of course, is very accurate and a view we also share. We could even elaborate a bit more on this quote in saying that the more hands that hold on to such weapons, the greater the risk that these weapons may be used one day. We therefore all have an interest in upholding the non-proliferation regime. Nuclear non-proliferation is essential, and it is important that we undertake all possible efforts to strengthen the non-proliferation regime. Of course, as all of you know, the NPT is often referred to as the cornerstone of this regime. The NPT is under a lot of pressure. There are states that have remained outside the NPT, others that have withdrawn. There are concerns about the nuclear programs of some states that are members of the NPT, but the NPT is not the only element of the non-proliferation regime. The nuclear disarmament debate has been strengthened and reinvigorated by new approaches, and I'm referring here to the humanitarian consequences discussion, the conference that was hosted in Oslo, and these discussions that will continue next year in Mexico. But we also equally have to look at new approaches or new narratives or new arguments to strengthen the case for non-proliferation. So we're very pleased today that Ward Wilson will be presenting a paper that will open up some of these new ideas to strengthen the non-proliferation regime. And most notably, of course, the strong case that he makes in his paper for deflating the symbolic value of nuclear weapons as a strong push to reinvigorate efforts to promote non-proliferation. We are very pleased and honoured to have Angela Kane, the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, moderating this discussion. And before I turn over the floor to her, I would just want to make two more comments. One, that this discussion is also being followed on Twitter, and the references are hashtag RethinkNukes and hashtag UNNOnProlif or UNNonProlif. So if you might find comments following this discussion there, and of course you might also yourself want to contribute to the discussion and tweet about this meeting. And finally, just to inform you that the presentations are being recorded, but not the discussion. So just to put you at ease, feel free and be very frank in the discussions and question and answer session. So with this, I'd like to turn over the floor to Angela, and thank you once again for having agreed to moderate this discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Benno, and also very warm welcome to Ward and to Barry here on my on the podium, and thank you for giving up your lunch hour, or rather having a very quick lunch, and then having food for thought rather than food for the stomach, and having read the interesting paper by Ward. I must refer to Ecclesiastes 1.9, which says, and I quote, "What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun," end quote. And there is certainly some wisdom in that. And it is certainly true that while history does not always repeat itself, at least it occasionally rhymes. But I think we take this wisdom a little bit too much to heart in the nuclear weapons field. It sometimes seems as if that the same statements are being repeated again and again when it comes to nuclear weapons. And all who follow such statements regularly in the First Committee, in the Disarmament Commission, and the Conference on Disarmament, as well as national policy statements, know exactly what I mean. And it is unfortunately also true that even the ideas themselves don't seem to evolve very much. The problem is therefore not just repetition, but an apparent lack of learning and adaptation. When it comes to nuclear weapons, perhaps a better source than even the Bible might be Abraham Lincoln, a man who presided over a time of far-reaching changes in the United States. And here is what he said in an annual message to Congress during the American Civil War. Quote, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." End quote. I believe, and I've said before, that we require new thinking about nuclear weapons. I agree with President Lincoln that as the case of nuclear weapons is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We seem to have fallen into the thrall of ideas that hold us frozen in place. Only if we break free of those bonds can we take the actions that are really needed. One of the reasons I like Ward Wilson's ideas is that they're generally unexpected and they're new. I don't always agree with what he says, but he certainly gets his audiences thinking. It's in exploring new ideas that I believe we will eventually find the path out of the nuclear dead end where we currently find ourselves. In his talk, Ward will examine how to strengthen nuclear nonproliferation. It is a subject that has been talked to almost to death, but I think you'll be surprised by Ward's approach. His thinking about political icons is fresh, and he has found a way to combine judiciously his iconoclasm on nuclear weapons with a healthy respect for the lessons of history. To tell you the truth, I'd never considered that dreadnoughts and chariots were relevant to the nuclear weapons discussion. But Ward makes an interesting case that we should see them in a new light. Most of us don't like to let go of our old beliefs. I know I don't. Once I've figured out the way the world is, I don't want to have to go back and rethink a problem. But in order to deal with the Gordian knot of nuclear weapons, we will all have to be a little uncomfortable. We will all have to give up some cherished ideas. And only when we see the world from a new perspective will we be able to begin to make real progress on this issue. Perhaps one of the most viral ideas that we've inherited has been the notion that nuclear nonproliferation can and should be pursued as an end in itself. Ward, however, is leading us to a different conclusion about the subject. He's exploring whether some of the deepest roots of proliferation, some of its most compelling motivations and causes, relate to the very existence of nuclear weapons themselves and to the ideas we have constructed to rationalize their possessions and threats of use. This is a profound insight indeed, for it suggests that the path to nonproliferation may well be through the great gate of disarmament. This is already the essence of the grand bargain at the heart of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty regime. Disarmament must never be seen as just a distant goal. It is instead a process accompanying progress on other fronts, including the elimination and nonproliferation of all weapons of mass destruction, the reduction in conventional arms, and the implementation of the fundamental norms of the Charter and international humanitarian law concerning the use of force and the obligation to resolve disputes peacefully. So I would now like to extend Ward a warm welcome to the United Nations. Tell us of your game-changing ideas. You help us all to find our way to a world free at last from nuclear threats. An eager global audience awaits. Over to you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Swiss Benno and Ms. Kane for having me here, and it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you. Strengthening non-proliferation is essential. If nuclear weapons continue their slow but steady spread across the globe, one day nuclear use, which could lead to catastrophic nuclear war, will be inevitable. There are outworn modes of thinking, however, Cold War mindsets that make strengthening non-proliferation much more difficult. In fact, they may even encourage states to acquire nuclear weapons. The end of the Cold War brought far-reaching changes. People no longer imagine that nuclear war is imminent. There are no crises between nuclear powers. Nuclear weapons are increasingly seen lightheartedly and as irrelevant. But among some government officials, the Cold War mindset lives on. The Cold War mindset sees nuclear weapons as almost exclusively about security, A fundamental assumption underlying this view is that when states consider acquiring nuclear weapons, the only thing on their minds is security. Because the Non-Proliferation Treaty is so important, people sometimes think that the non-proliferation regime consists entirely of measures to restrict the supply of nuclear materials and technology. But a key element in reducing the spread of nuclear weapons is curbing demand. The Cold War mindset sees this demand entirely in terms of security. NATO, the US-Japan Treaty, the US-South Korean Treaty, and many others, all these are designed to reassure states that their security is not threatened. The belief is that if they feel their security is not threatened, they won't be tempted to build nuclear weapons. Experts in nuclear-armed states are sure that decisions about acquiring nuclear weapons have been and always will be based on security. Preventing the spread of nuclear weapons, however, depends on what other people think about nuclear weapons, not on what people in nuclear-armed states think. Is there another plausible way to think about nuclear weapons? In religion, icons are objects that are expensive, difficult to acquire, they're kept in a secluded spot, they're treated with awe and veneration, and they're believed to watch over and protect those who believe in them. Nuclear weapons are also objects that are expensive and difficult to acquire, that are kept in a secluded spot, that are treated with awe and veneration, and that are believed to watch over and protect those who believe in them. It would be, of course, wrong to confuse nuclear weapons with icons. Icons don't move, they don't explode, they can't kill millions of people. But what if someone confused icons with nuclear weapons? Is it possible? Right-thinking people are not the only ones who decide the course of history. Would it be possible for government officials in a state that was considering acquiring nuclear weapons to see nuclear weapons as symbolic icons, icons of power, rather than as actual weapons? Imagine a scholar who has been tasked by his government to discern whether nuclear weapons are really weapons or just icons. Imagine he's inclined to believe that nuclear weapons are just icons. Could this scholar, this nuclear weapons as icons theorist, build a coherent theory supported by a body of evidence to show that nuclear weapons are icons? The first and most important piece of evidence in his theory would be that nuclear weapons are never used. Real weapons get used. Precision weapons, AK-47s, drones are used all the time. They're obviously weapons of war. Nuclear weapons just sit in silos. Second piece of evidence would be that the military role of nuclear weapons has declined. Nuclear arsenals are dramatically smaller. Many types of nuclear weapons have been taken out of service. Some states are de-emphasizing them in their defensive strategy. If states at one time thought that nuclear weapons were real weapons, but gradually came to see that they only had symbolic value, wouldn't this fit the facts? Wouldn't this storyline fit the facts? Deterrence is particularly strong evidence that nuclear weapons are not real weapons. After all, deterrence experts in nuclear-armed states constantly say that no one really wants to use nuclear weapons. They're really only just for deterrence. Nuclear weapons as icons theorists would respond, well, what sort of weapons are never used? The obvious answer is symbolic weapons. So, is there apparent evidence to support the idea that nuclear weapons are just icons? Yes, there certainly is. Have there ever been weapons in the past that had little military value but took on significant political importance as symbols of power? In fact, there have. British battleship HMS Dreadnought was launched in February 1906 and immediately became an icon. It was bigger, faster, had the latest technology, and had larger guns than any previous battleship. Became a symbol of British national pride. Huge crowds turned out to see it. Its effect overseas was equally great. It touched off an arms race. Japan, France, Italy, Russia, United States, even Hungary, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, all began building similar ships. And Germany decided that they were going to match or surpass the British fleet. The Kaiser told the King of Italy that with a fleet of dreadnoughts, other leaders would be more respectful. The number of dreadnoughts you had became the measure of how powerful you were. Now, of course, in practice, it turned out that battleships were already outmoded. They were vulnerable to submarines in World War I and then aircraft in World War II. But what dreadnoughts demonstrate is the way in which military weapons can become symbols. Symbols of power, symbols of national pride, symbols of international standing. Ironically, the iconic value of battleships was far greater than their limited military value. Chariots as well were weapons that at one time were must-have weapons. They were the latest technology. They were expensive and difficult to obtain. They inspired fear in adversaries. They appear in stone carvings again and again in the ancient world, touting the works of conquerors. States lavished money on them. But they were not very good military weapons. Foot soldiers with moderate discipline could easily overwhelm charging chariots, and the suspension they had was so rudimentary that they were difficult and dangerous for all but the simplest tasks. But despite their military drawbacks, they were status symbols and military icons for hundreds of years. Dreadnoughts and chariots share some characteristics. They were the latest technology. They were expensive. They were difficult to acquire. And even though they had limited military utility, they deeply impressed adversaries. Interestingly, these are all characteristics which they share with nuclear weapons, which are considered the latest technology. They are expensive, they are difficult to acquire, and even though they have limited military utility, they deeply impress adversaries. Nuclear weapons are icons theorists could point to the past and show that weapons had become icons of power before. A theory of nuclear weapons as icons would have to be able to explain the history of nuclear proliferation. So seen from a security perspective, the UK's decision to acquire a small nuclear arsenal raises some questions. The United Kingdom was an island, after all, and it had no direct threat from the Soviet Union, which is a land power. The UK also had its security buttressed by the NATO alliance that it was a member of and by a special relationship with the US. Why build a nuclear arsenal, a small arsenal, when you already have these security assurances? Seen from the nuclear weapons or icons perspective, though, the decision makes some sense. The United Kingdom was in the process of losing its empire in the post-war world, and the urge to have at least a symbol of power is understandable. From a security perspective, China's nuclear arsenal decisions are confusing. China never built a large arsenal like the US and Soviet Union. It could have. Why didn't it? But seen from a nuclear weapons or icons perspective, the decision makes perfect sense. Since nuclear weapons are merely symbolic tokens of power, it's not necessary to have large numbers. France's decision to acquire nuclear weapons is not entirely consistent from a security perspective. France was protected by NATO, had an alliance with the United States. Why build a small, separate arsenal of nuclear weapons? Seen through a symbolic lens, their decision seems more natural. France, at one time the center of culture and learning and scientific achievement, so many other important elements of civilization, was struggling in the 50s to maintain its status as a great power. the decision to acquire a radiant symbol of French technical prowess and political power makes some sense from that perspective. India's 24 years of resisting the urge to build actual weapons, even after achieving a nuclear capability in 1974, could be taken as very strong evidence that nuclear weapons are merely icons. What better proof than the fact that this country felt satisfied for so many years with just having the icon and not building the weapons themselves? Pakistan, similarly, had a capability to build nuclear weapons for many years, but chose not to. More supporting evidence. North Korea has hardly treated their nuclear weapons as vital tools for national defense. They've gone backwards and forwards so many times, starting and stopping their weapons program, that to some observers, it seems as if their nuclear arsenal is more like a bargaining chip than a vital element of national security that you have to rush to procure. Bargaining chips are more closely related to icons than to weapons. Iran appears to want to have the capacity to build nuclear weapons without actually crossing the line. This would be a status much like Pakistan's, having the capability but not testing or weaponizing. And this sort of behavior fits perfectly with a nuclear weapons are icons theory. So is it possible to construct a coherent theory that argues that nuclear weapons are icons of power? Yes, it is. Could government officials in states thinking about acquiring nuclear weapons find evidence in the historical record that supports the idea that nuclear weapons are not really weapons, but simply very valuable political symbols? Again, the answer is yes, there's plenty of evidence. Could they mistakenly believe that nuclear weapons are just icons? Yes, they could easily think so. Well, what effect would such a misconception have on how states view the world? How could the notion that nuclear weapons are just icons cause states to see the security policies and non-proliferation efforts of nuclear-armed states? Weapons that have no plausible military use, but which are called essential in defense policy statements, raise questions. Some people might conclude they are essential because of their symbolic value. So an unexceptional statement seen from a security perspective, nuclear weapons are essential, actually would inflate the value of nuclear weapons as icons enormously, seen from the nuclear weapons as icons perspective. Weapons that have no plausible military use but are kept on constant alert, costing billions of dollars a year, are clearly symbolic weapons with tremendous value. Even through the security, seen through the security lens as a simple measure to guard against sudden attack, it could be read as confirmation that these political symbols are so powerful that they're worth spending a fortune on. Nuclear-armed states see the NATO alliance as a key way to discourage proliferation. European nations would all build nuclear weapons if NATO were not a nuclear-based alliance, it's often said. Nuclear weapons as icons theorists, however, could see and hear a different message. They could see this as proof that nuclear weapons are the most valuable tokens of commitment in the world. If you want allies, you must have nuclear weapons. The more you insist that NATO and other alliances must be nuclear, the higher you inflate the symbolic value of nuclear weapons. All permanent members of the Security Council have nuclear weapons. Well, this is, of course, an accident of history. All but two of those states acquired nuclear weapons after becoming members. But nuclear weapons as icons theorists could look at that and see it as proof that if you want to be respected, if you want a seat at the high table, you must have nuclear weapons. Seeing the world through a single, narrow, Cold War lens, the nuclear security lens, causes states to say and do things that unintentionally inflate the symbolic value of nuclear weapons. Cold War thinking unable to imagine the possibility of new ways of seeing nuclear weapons, could lead to proliferation. If states see nuclear weapons not as weapons, but as powerful political symbols that confer enormous status and influence, and that are not particularly dangerous because they'll never be used, they see them that way. That will put intense pressure on those states to acquire nuclear weapons. And time is not on our side. With each year that passes, the case for nuclear weapons being just symbols appears to grow. The longer nuclear weapons are not used, the more likely states are to see them as icons, not weapons. Therefore, one of the vital tasks in nonproliferation today is to deflate the symbolic value of nuclear weapons. Deflating their value removes an important source of proliferation pressure. And it's not necessary to abolish nuclear weapons or surrender their military capabilities in order to deflate their symbolic value. Military value and symbolic value can be separated. One step would be to de-emphasize nuclear weapons in policy statements. Nuclear armed states could simply change the way they talk about nuclear weapons, not refer to them as essential, not say that they're the ultimate guarantee of state sovereignty. Another step would be to remove nuclear weapons from constant alert. Some nuclear armed states have always kept their weapons at a low level of readiness, and both the United States and Russia have done so at various times. Keeping nuclear weapons on high alert signals that they are crucial weapons you cannot be without for even a minute. Taking them off alert de-emphasizes and deflates their iconic value. Insisting that NATO and other alliances must be underpinned by nuclear deterrence signals that it is not possible to assure the safety of allies without nuclear weapons. This is one of the most damaging pieces of evidence that nuclear weapons as icons theorists could point to. A commitment to eventually denuclearize all alliances would be a large step forward in deflating their iconic value. Adding non-nuclear members to the Security Council would prevent people from holding the mistaken belief that in order to be important in the world, you have to have nuclear weapons. And interestingly, the current movement that emphasizes humanitarian consequences happens to offer an opportunity to deflate the symbolic value of nuclear weapons. By endorsing the notion that nuclear weapons cause unacceptable humanitarian consequences, states emphasize the military nature of nuclear weapons. They remind people that nuclear weapons are weapons intended to be used, not symbols that just sit in silos. Proliferation of nuclear weapons poses a serious and growing danger. Each state that acquires the weapons adds to this danger. Nonproliferation must be seen as an essential task. In the long run, the greatest proliferation threat facing the world is that states will come to see nuclear weapons not as weapons, but as symbols, and rush to build them. The most important step to strengthening nonproliferation today, therefore, is to make certain that the military nature of these weapons is unmistakable, and that the idea that they're merely political symbols is discredited. Only if we can deflate the value of nuclear weapons as symbols can we hope to prevent their spread in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ward. I promised you an interesting presentation since I clearly read the paper beforehand, and I think I didn't promise too much. But I'd like to hand over to Barry Blackman, who is now going to comment the paper that Ward has presented. Barry.
Thank you very much. I think I may have been the first, but I'm certainly a very strong and loyal member of the Ward Wilson fan club. I think Ward has brought fresh thinking to this field in many ways, and this paper is another example of that. And I agree fundamentally with with his point about the how many nations perceive nuclear weapons primarily for their symbolic value as an icon, and that paying attention to this motivation for acquiring weapons, nuclear weapons, is very important when we think about ways to stem and even hopefully reverse proliferation over time. It's certainly the case when you think of why Britain and France, for example, would want to spend the huge amounts that they're going to spend, apparently, to maintain their nuclear forces. You have to think of it in terms of the symbolic value these countries perceive in having these weapons, given their status in the world otherwise. And certainly, if there is problems in the non-proliferation regime, say if there are difficulties in the 2015 review conference and more states begin to think of acquiring nuclear weapons, it'll be the symbolic apparent or the perceived symbolic value of those weapons which might motivate countries like Brazil, which doesn't face serious external security problems, to think of making those kinds of investments in acquiring weapons. But we also have to understand that all states that acquire nuclear weapons or think about acquiring them have mixed motives. There's both the prestige, symbolic motive, and there's also a security motive. And when an aspect of proliferation which Ward does not address in his paper, but which worries me, is vertical proliferation, a new trend toward vertical proliferation which we're seeing today. Certainly, this is not the case in the West, but when we look at Russia and its writings about nuclear weapons, its military exercises, one which just concluded several weeks ago, which simulated the use of battlefield nuclear weapons to end a conflict in its what it considers its near abroad, and which has announced plans for a major modernization of its nuclear weapons up to the START ceiling, and refuses to discuss reductions in its large number of battlefield weapons, one perceives a security motivation rather than a symbolic motivation. Similarly, China, which, as Ward pointed out, for many, many years maintained a minimal deterrent posture and therefore might have seen symbolism as an important motivation for its acquiring nuclear weapons, also understands them as a means of security. After all, China was threatened with nuclear attack by the United States on more than one occasion in the 1950s, and when its then ally, the Soviet Union, essentially told them they were on their own, they, in fact, started their nuclear program and became a nuclear power. China is now changing its nuclear posture. It's pursuing a diversified number of nuclear weapon systems, which will go beyond, or apparently seems to be going beyond, the minimal posture that it maintained for so many years. Pakistan is a third country which apparently sees security as primary motivation for acquiring a rather large number of weapons for a country that size, faced with a threat from its neighbor, a larger country with larger conventional forces. It apparently perceives that nuclear weapons will provide some security to it and sees a deterrent value in them. So And these are the three countries that are primarily responsible at this point for vertical proliferation. And I believe security is a motivation in all three cases. We also need to look at the new proliferators. And I would disagree with Ward about the case of North Korea. Yes, they went back and forth with their program for many years, but there are many reasons for that. But North Korea is certainly a country which has been threatened with nuclear attack by the United States on several occasions. It's always been a part of our alliance with South Korea, and it's been emphasized at different times in our difficult history with that country. So we have to consider both motivations. Nuclear weapons as symbols of prestige and national power, but nuclear weapons misperceived, in my view, as a means of improving a country's security. Finally, let me just turn to the prescriptions Ward had at his at the end, all of which I can certainly agree with, regardless of the motivation of the proliferation. The steps he recommends are would be very helpful if they were undertaken by as many countries as possible. And continuing to delegitimate nuclear weapons, as Ward has done himself, and as many others, many individuals and organizations have done, is a very important step in maintaining the taboo against their use and even against their testing, which is certainly a very powerful means of delegitimating these weapons. I, for one, was greatly heartened by the uproar which followed Syria's use of chemical weapons and the resulting agreement to an agreement by the Syrian government and other countries to destroy those weapons as something that had implications for nuclear weapons as well. And one could hope that the few remaining holdouts on the chemical treaty might be encouraged to follow Syria's example. They live in the same neighborhood for the most part. But particularly important, I think, among Ward's recommendations is the need to de-emphasize the nuclear component in extended deterrence commitments. I don't think it can be eliminated at this point, but it certainly could be de-emphasized. It's certainly possible for those few remaining U.S. battlefield weapons to be removed from Europe. They serve no military purpose, as our own military men will say. The Stimson Center recently put out a report, which by a group of very distinguished former military and civilian defense officials, which recommended that our tactical weapons be greatly reduced and no steps be taken to maintain them in Europe, meaning the new aircraft that would be required not be given a nuclear capability. In East Asia, similarly, it's possible to de-emphasize the nuclear component of the commitment and to make clear that the U.S. Could fulfill its commitment to South Korea without even considering the use of nuclear weapons, and that would be a very positive step. So I'll just conclude that I agree with Ward. I urge that we not lose sight of the fact that some countries do misperceive nuclear weapons as conferring some security to them. I think that's a misperception, but nonetheless, it's held by a few nations. So we have to work on both aspects, the symbolic one as well as the security one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barry, for this commentary. That was very good, and I think you now know why we talked about dreadnoughts and chariots, and basically I wonder whether that means that we have to have a more powerful weapon than a nuclear one in order to make nuclear weapons obsolete. One of the issues I wanted to raise, and I'm looking forward to your question also, is that's one that Ward did not address, and that is the possession of nuclear weapons as status symbols. There are states that are very powerful indeed that have given up voluntarily nuclear weapons. I mean, just to mention two of them, South Africa and Brazil, and I don't think they're both candidates for permanent seats under the reform of the Security Council, and I don't think that it really did them any damage in terms of their world standing by having given up nuclear weapons. And last week, you recall, there was a side event sponsored by Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Ukraine, also from their perspective of voluntarily having given up nuclear weapons and sort of bring in the lessons that they have learned from that, which again go into the same direction. So I think the status issue, we need to look at a little bit more closely also. But I've said enough. I'd like to open it up for questions or for comments addressed to Ward, challenging him maybe or contributing to his views. So please, I think you're going to have to raise your hands, and I'm going to rely on my fellow colleagues on the podium here to if I've missed someone. Yes, of course.